Okay, so we're going to talk about monetary disequilibrium theory. I've separated the analytics of this into two parts, and this is not completely satisfactory. It's sort of hard to make this distinction complete. But I first want to talk about what I'll call conceptions of monetary equilibrium and monetary disequilibrium. We'll do this from the viewpoint of the monetary disequilibrium theorists and then from our viewpoint. And then I want to talk about the dynamics of what happens in the market economy when there's a change in the money relation. And then we'll do this, of course, you've read some of this, you know that there's an important distinction that they make between good side and money side. So we'll integrate all of that. And I'll try to stay away. I know that Dr. Baggus already did free banking, so I don't want to dwell on free banking issues. But obviously they come up, right? So there's some overlap here. Okay, so let's just start with the conception of monetary disequilibrium theorists have of monetary equilibrium and monetary disequilibrium. What exactly do they mean by this? And they define it, the initial definition is just the same as the kind of standard definition that we would expect to hear, we would accept ourselves as Austrians. They say total demand for money equals total stock of money, and by money demand they mean holding money, just like the Rothbardian position, at the existing price level. And so monetary disequilibrium would obviously mean that they're not the same. The total demand to hold money and the total stock of money are not the same at the existing price level. However, there are a whole bunch of addendums that suddenly are attached to this. Right? That's not the only condition for monetary equilibrium, according to them. For example, they say, and we'll make more comments about this in a minute, but they say that in a mature banking system, the demand for money will only be for fiduciary media. All money proper, whatever it happens to be, it could be fiat money or it could be gold, silver, commodity money, will be held by the banking system. So when they say demand for money is equal to the stock of money, they mean the demand for holding fiduciary media, the demand for holding deposits, or bank notes. we'll see again why that's important as we go through this discussion. Secondly, they say the second condition that's added, addendum that's added, is that this equalization of total demand and total stock for money is simultaneously bringing the loanable funds market into equilibrium. So that too, that's part of monetary equilibrium, is that in the credit markets, the demand for credit and the supply of credit are also equal at what they call the natural rate of interest. So the Wechselian rate of interest. Now here, they rely upon the claim that the connecting factor between the two markets, the money on the one side and credit on the other, is that there is their claim that the demand for fiduciary media expresses time preference. It's part of the expression of time preference, and their argument is it's part of the expression of time preference because it entails a reduction of consumption. So again, we'll criticize this as we go along, but that's another condition that they place upon this. And the idea is that because of this, when the demand for some people increases for fiduciary media, the banking system responds by producing more of it, and they transfer spending then from those who are increasing their demand for fiduciary media to borrowers, and therefore the aggregate spending stream stays the same. Right? That's why they're creating this connection, because they want to be able to argue in favor of keeping the spending stream, the aggregate spending stream, the same. Now, let me also point out that their notion of market clearing is not the same as the Austrian idea. You've read the paper by Laura Davidson, who brings this out quite nicely. Their idea of market clearing is that the ex ante plans are coordinated at market clearing. So they have a more abstract notion of market clearing than the plain state of rest. They have this idea that only when quantity demand and quantity supplied are ex ante equal and ex post do we have market clearing. So again, that bears upon what we would say in response to this. Also, they accept this view from Leland Yeager that one of the problems that's created in the money market is the fact that there is no separate money market in which the money relation clears. So the money relation must clear in all markets throughout the economy. And right, so that creates, in a sense, the basic problem. There's something like a difference between when the money relation changes, it creates a general price adjustment in all the goods markets throughout the economy, because there is no single money market in which the adjustment can take place. Whereas on the goods side, when you know, demand for goods change, then we can adjust market by market as the economy moves along. So they have this degree of separation of the money side from the goods side of the economy that's far beyond, Mises's kind of analytical distinction between these things. We could separate these two elements analytically, but as I'll argue in a minute, in practice, in actual action, they're inseparable. We can't separate them. Okay, so this is one of the problems that arises in monetary disequilibrium. If it occurs from a money side change, then it creates adjustment problems in the market, because the adjustment has to be done throughout the whole market economy, whereas good side changes don't have to be adjusted throughout the economy. So that's one of their basic arguments in distinguishing disequilibrium from equilibrium. Now, another problem from money side changes that Horowitz inserts in this is that he says, and I'm not really sure what to make of this, but he says that when the money side changes, the change in the array of prices is the unintended consequence of these changes. Whereas when the goods side changes, if we increase our demand for goods or we increase the supply of goods, the price change is intended. And he seems to be implying that if the price changes are intended, then they can be made more smoothly. He doesn't actually say that, but he just sort of leaves this hanging. So that might be a point of discussion for us. In addition to this, another aspect of their whole conception of this equilibrizing situation is their theory of price. And so they have a kind of Hayekian conception of price. For example, Horowitz points out that prices, or he conceives of it this way, prices are signals. And what they're signaling to people are the relative exchange ratios between goods. So they have something of this neoclassical notion that they're real underlying exchange ratios between goods. And that's what people really need to know, and that's what they're, you know, basing their decisions on, and so on. And so money side changes introduce noise into this. It's like the fluttering veil of Yeager. We have to filter this out. If a money side change occurs, we get all these changes in money prices, but what we're really after are just seeing what the actual underlying exchange ratios are between goods. And then one last thing that I'll mention in this discussion, where they're just laying out the notions of disequilibrium and why it's problematic. Horowitz says it this way. He says, when people increase their demand for money, when they hold more money, this weakens what he calls notional demand for goods. So the idea is that when people hold money, their demand for goods is no longer effective. It's just potential. I could in the future, I might spend the money again, and then my demand for goods would be made effective. in the market. But if I'm just holding money, my demands are only notional, right? Potential is how I take it to mean this, right? And therefore, when people increase their demand for money, Say's law will not hold anymore in the market, because effective demands won't be forthcoming, even though we really want the goods and we produce the goods and so on. The goods will not be bought. There's actually a scarcity of money, he claims, to buy the goods. Now, clearly, this also has something to do with prices. And the obvious response to this will be, well, why don't prices just adjust to, make markets clear? So we'll get into that in a minute.
Jeff, a point to make. Does he actually say somewhere scarcity of money is a scarcity of money?
Yeah, he actually, it's actually a scarcity of money. So what's our response to this? I think the basic response is, and this is, by the way, is in all of this is in, I think, implicit, if not explicit, in theory of money and credit. I think it's all, the answer to all of this is in there. But anyway, the basic answer is to build our theorizing about this from the preference range. We have to go back, in other words, to the beginning point of all of our theorizing, which is our valuations, making judgments of preference between things. So let's suppose we have something, a person's preference rank, and it looks like this. So this person, let's say at the price of an iPad were $500, this person would not buy the iPad. Right? The person has a certain money holding, a certain demand for goods that are intertwined, they're interrelated, they're relative to one another, but in different ways. And so if one of them changes, then they both must change. If tomorrow the preference looks like this and the guy buys the iPad, then we can't tell from the person's action whether the value of the iPad went up or the value of money went down or some combination, right? All we see is that as an objective scientist, is that the person's evaluation of the good relative to money has changed. That's all we can say. Again, analytically, we can divide these, right? And we can conjecture about which one is changing and so on and so forth. But in real action, they're bound up together. So we would have, if we wanted to do the market analysis of this, right, we have the iPad and the price, and there'd be supply and demand. This is the original position, the original preference rank. And then there'd be some corresponding complementary demand that this guy has for money. And along with everybody else's demand, leads to the PPM. And when we get the change, then the demand for goods has gone up. Right? We've seen this switch. And at the same time, the demand for money has gone down. So these are synchronous. There isn't any way to disentangle these in real action. They're always taking place together. So this whole distinction between good side and money side is incorrect, the way they use it, the way the monetary disequilibrium theorists use it. These are just, to talk about the good side and the money side is to talk about the reverse and obverse of the same coin. We're just looking at two sides to the same thing, right? And as Laura Davison pointed out, what happens in this process then as preference ranks change is that we get this moment-by-moment plain state of rest adjustment. So right in the market, we get immediate adjustment, right? This guy walks into an Apple store and he buys the iPad. And his money and the money relation is also clear, so to speak, right? It's simultaneously doing this moment-by-moment. And if enough people are changing their preferences, then prices begin to adjust. But as the price of the iPad goes up, correspondingly, the price of money goes down. There's no distinguishing element here. Okay, now let's go on to the second aspect of this. This is the claim that they make about demand for money expressing time preference. So again, I think this is just a fundamental mistake. They say, remember, that the demand for fiduciary media, at least, expresses time preference because it reduces consumption. But this, of course, is not correct. Time preference is expressed by the ratio of saving to consumption, not by the absolute amount of consumption. And so it's just not the case that if we increase our demand for money, fiduciary media or otherwise, that our time preference changes. You know, Rothbard gives us this helpful income dispersion equation, that income is dispersed into consumption, saving, and investing, investment expenditures, and money holdings. And so if we have this guy with $100,000 in income, and let's say he disperses it, like this initially, so that the ratio of saving to consumption is 20%. That's determined by his time preference, right? Time preference determines this ratio of 20% saving to consumption, not the absolute amount of consumption. And so let's suppose that this guy wants to increase his money holding to 10,000. How does he redistribute in order to get this 10,000? Well, he doesn't reduce his consumption relative to saving if his time preference stays the same. He adjusts them in proportion. In this case, it would look like this. So that the proportion between saving and consumption remains the same, 20%. So again, this is just a basic error, right, to say that a demand for money must be expressed by a reduction in consumption, which would then change the ratio between saving and consumption. That just isn't so. Okay, another point to make about this is that the holder of money, if somebody increases their demand for money, even though, again, this isn't consumption, it is a present good. The holder of money retains ownership over a present good. The saver doesn't do this, right? The saver surrenders ownership of a present good and the present satisfaction it commands in order to invest these resources or this good to obtain future goods. So the whole conception of what they're saying is incorrect. It's not only just sort of incorrect in the sense of its implications, but it's incorrect from a conceptual standpoint. And then we might also point out on this particular line of thought that demand for money proper, it isn't obvious that it would be zero, even in our world where fractional reserve banking is given impetus by legal privilege. The demand for money proper is not zero. Just to give you the figures, before, you know, the typical standard proportion in M1, before the crisis was that 75% of M1, roughly 75-80% of M1, were checkable deposits and about 25% cash holdings. And when the crisis came, that proportion changed to roughly 50-50 as people moved towards cash, right, and away from riskier, as they perceive it, riskier demand deposits. So this is not only not the case that, you know, we can presuppose a situation in which demand for money proper is zero. This is constantly changing, this proportion between, this optimal proportion people have between holding money proper and holding a medium, holding a money substitute. As Professor Salerno has pointed out, if we can imagine a world where all the legal privileges are eliminated for banks who issue money substitutes, under those conditions, the demand people would have for fiduciary media would be perhaps at least minuscule, right? And the reason for this is it doesn't really matter that banks pay customers interest on their demand deposits, that's not enough to create a large portion of their money holdings in demand deposits. This is because whether or not something is a money substitute depends upon the clientele of the bank, not upon the customers. The clientele have to accept the money substitute as redeemable on demand at par without question. Otherwise, they won't consider it a substitute for money. And so these two things, you know, in a sense, work against each other, so to speak. And it isn't obvious that that the interest paid would, be the dominant factor. It might be quite the contrary. Okay, let me mention also, and then this market clearing idea that the Austrians have is that market clearing is a plain state of rest. And so, as we pointed out before, the market is constantly readjusting and clearing as preferences change. You know, people going into the stores and buying things, and then the entrepreneurs adjusting to this, and moment by moment, the market proceeding. And so, we don't really have anything like violations of Say's law and so on and so forth in this process. Now, we're not talking yet about the dynamics of how this works out. We're just saying that this is sort of a conceptual misunderstanding or a definitional problem about market clearing. But a more important point about market clearing is this. The monetary disequilibrium theorists seem to imply that one can identify whether or not a market clears by objective evidence. This is not so. Market clearing is determined, like other factors involved in human action, by our subjective preferences. And let me just give you one example of this. I heard just a couple weeks ago. So we have the shoe company Nike, and Nike introduced a new Air Jordan shoe. So they're still making money off Michael Jordan. And what they do, their strategy in introducing the shoe is to price it at such a point where customers know that the stores are going to run out. They're going to physically run out, an hour after they open the door. Why do they do this? Well, they create social buzz for their product. Right? They create these long lines and these stories about people, sitting overnight in a line to get into the store so that they get the shoes. And they're all tweeting, hey, I got my shoes. And this creates buzz for the product and actually increases their, so they think, I guess, increases their sales over time. Sales of other Nike products and so on and so forth. Is that market clearing? Yes. Yes, that market, if the shelves are empty, that market is cleared. That's exactly the result that Nike wanted. So that's no evidence. If inventories run down, that's no evidence that markets are not clearing. If inventories are built up, that's no evidence whatsoever that markets are, not clearing. So we have to be careful about how we think about the adjustment processes in the market. I would also say on this question of Say's law and the claim about notional demands for money, it seems to me that wouldn't it be true that the same thing would be the case in a barter world? What if we're all trading? We have these trading relationships and they're ongoing, and then suddenly I start to hold goods. What if I just hold on to some goods? Won't that also then create lack of sales for other people who, depended upon my exchange of these goods? And wouldn't we get the exact same kind of adjustment process necessary? In other words, prices would have to adjust. Barter exchange ratios would have to adjust in that economy in order to bring us back to the general equilibrium point. I don't see that there's any difference between holding money or just holding goods in a barter world. It seems to represent the same kind of problem. I think this is just a red herring. And then let me finally, in this section, talk about our conception of money prices. Most of you are familiar with this, right? So we can do this briefly. But the Misesian conception is that money prices are the necessary requisites of economic calculation. That there are no such thing, no useful notion of underlying barter exchange ratios between goods, underlying exchange ratios between goods. All decisions are made with respect to money prices in the market, with respect to money prices themselves. And relative exchange ratios simply don't matter. All that matter are actual, real, historical money prices. And so if you know the money relation changes and this creates changes in money prices throughout the economy, that there's no difference analytically between that and good side changes that create differences in money prices throughout the economy. It's exactly the same phenomenon. And, you know, we treat it, or we can treat it analytically in exactly the same way. Okay, now let me, when we transition to talking about the adjustment process, let me just talk about the cases of monetary disequilibrium. Again, I think this is revealing just to have as background to kind of think through what the arguments are. So let's write these out. How could we generate a monetary disequilibrium? What would be the possible options? And remember, this is when we have good side and money side. We're accepting this distinction between good side and money side. So we could have change in demand for goods. That would be one possibility. Generally, demand for goods goes up in the economy on the part of people. And how would the monetary disequilibrium theorists then discuss this particular case? What would they say here? And by the way, if you've read through this material, you know that they don't talk about this case. When they talk about the good side, they only talk about supply. They only talk about production, right? Increased production of goods. They don't talk about the case where demand for goods would change. But why not, right? If we have a good side and a money side, can't demand for goods go up or down? And if so, what adjustment process would they say the market goes through? So I'm speculating here because they don't lay this out, but I think what they would say is something like this. I think they would say, if there's an increase in demand for goods, this would create excess demand for goods. Simultaneously, this creates excess supply of money. Right? So we get this imbalance in the money market. And then we have to have price inflation to readjust. And so they say the market can handle this because the disruption is occurring in individual goods markets. And they would just go one by one.
Right.
So the bread demand for bread goes up, and then the adjustment could take place in the bread market. And this simultaneously then would dissipate the disequilibrium in the money market, so to speak. The Austrian view of this, as we've already mentioned, is somewhat different, right? The Austrian view is that if we have an increased demand for goods, we synchronously have a reduced demand for money, that these two are just two different ways of saying the same thing. And this adjustment process then would occur without any excess demands or supplies. It would just occur as plain states of rest change. It would move, moment by moment to a new a final state of rest, if we're holding other factors the same, but a new set array of prices. But there would be no disequilibrium with respect to the actual trading that's going on in markets. And so again, this is not quite as problematic. Also, expectations would play a role in the way in which the process unfolds. Right? So, depending upon how entrepreneurs anticipate this change in the demand for goods, it would unfold in a somewhat different way. The price could just immediately raise the price if they anticipate that our demands over the next week or something are going to go up, and then the adjustment process would be finished. So successful entrepreneurship would speed up the adjustment process. Okay, now let me also the other thing that distinguishes the Austrian view, again pointed out by Laura Davison, is that a change in the we also can integrate into a change in demand for goods a change in the reservation demand for goods. Right? This is already built into the analysis when we talk about change in demand for goods. It could be exchange demand or reservation demand. We've already got that part of the analysis built in here. So a change in supply of existing goods is already built into this discussion that we just went through about how our analytics would treat this change in demand. This is just a change in reservation demand sets in motion then the same process, right? If you're increasing your reservation demand for goods, you're lowering your reservation demand for money. You get the synchronous adjustment, and then we just move through plain states of rest to the new resting point. Okay, then we could have a change in supply of goods. And here we have to specify that this is
this is by production. We specify this case because this is the one that the monetary disequilibrium theorists talk about. But secondly, because we've already covered the case of changing the supply of existing goods from the Austrian view in the first category, right? So we don't. So this is a different instance. Now, again, I'm not sure they don't elaborate on this, but my supposition is that they would treat this as they treated the change in, as I've suggested, they would treat the change in demand for goods. They would just say, okay, if there's an increase in production of goods, it's create excess supply of the goods. It would be a counterbalancing excess demand for money. And then we'd go through this adjustment, right? We get the excess supply of goods. And the reason why this adjusts, this is a monetary disequilibrium, right? They would claim. But the reason we get adjustment here is because it's occurring in each goods market one by one. Right? And there's a difference from the goods side relative to the money side. So it creates excess supply of goods. Then we get price deflation because of the corresponding excess demand for money. Okay, so that's their basic idea. Now, the Austrian conception of this is, again, different. And it's different in this way. When we talk about change in the supply of goods by production, production is always guided by demands, by the pattern of demands. And so if we're in an equilibrium situation without any change in demands, in the array of demands, there could be no change in the production or some other underlying factor, right? There could be no change in production. There's no sort of arbitrary change in production through supply. It's always integrated into the array of demands. This is even true for technological improvement because that's also based upon entrepreneurs' economic calculation of the eventual value of the R&D that they do to bring forth these technological improvements. Even that is determined by their anticipation of demands for the goods that would be produced through this technology. And they don't see any of that, they won't invest, and there won't be technological improvement. The monetary disequilibrium theorists treat this like neoclassical economists, right? It's just a thing to be manipulated. It's just another variable to be manipulated. We'll see why this is important in a minute, why it's important to make this distinction, because as we'll see, the same thing is true about adjustments of the production of money. So that's the more important case we want to get to, right? Okay, then there can be change in demand for money. Okay, and here we have to specify another condition. So the monetary disequilibrium theorists say that the market cannot adjust to, you know, smoothly to changes in demand for money without an elastic currency. And of course, their preferred way of giving us the elastic currency is through their conception of free banking or monetary freedom or whatever they're calling it these days. The basic reason for this we've suggested already is that if there's an increase in the demand for money, this would require economy-wide adjustment in the prices of all markets because there is no money market in which the adjustment can take place. That's their sort of starting point analysis of why this is problematic, whereas good side changes are not, even though they create monetary disequilibrium too, the good side changes. Okay, now the Austrian conception here is that, of course, the market can adjust without elastic currency because this sort of a change is no different than the change in demand for goods. So, and we'll talk about the dynamics of this in a minute. But the basic point is, you know, if you get an increase in demand for goods, this is synchronous with a reduction in, increase in demand for money, it's synchronous with a reduction in demand for goods. And then as people's preferences change, they go into markets and they reduce their expenditures on things, and we get these emerging plain states of rest. And the entrepreneurs then adjust prices, and then they adjust their factor demands and so on. And again, that's a dynamic feature that we'll talk about more in a minute, but that would be the basic argument. And remember, then there are also expectations involved, right? Entrepreneurs can anticipate that there would be these changes in these movements in
demand for their goods and anticipate them and sort of put in motion a more expeditious adjustment process. But again, this is we wouldn't view this as any different from the adjustment process that takes place when the demand for goods changes. It's just like the, again, obverse side compared to the reverse side of the same coin. Okay, then we get the final case that I want to look at. And this is, and by the way, the same would be true for reservation demand for money. Again, Laura Davison handled that in her paper, that exchange demand for money and reservation. So there'd be change in supply of money by production. And this is where we get into the dynamics of the two views, the monetary disequilibrium and the Austrian view. Okay, so the monetary disequilibrium theorists say that fiduciary media, under free banking, the issue of fiduciary media responds to a demand. So if there's an increased demand for fiduciary media, then we get a proportionate, an equal, so to speak, equal in amount at the given price level, increase in the production of fiduciary media so that the spending stream stays the same. And then this just generates a certain effect in the economy, right? A stable nominal GDP but at least a stable spending stream. Now, remember, the Austrian response to this is any issue of fiduciary media will generate malinvestments. Any issue whatsoever of this would be our response. We want to look at whether or not that's a viable response. But the basic Austrian response, it doesn't matter why it's done and so on. Any issue will generate malinvestments along the lines of the business cycle. Okay, now what do the Austrians say? The Austrians say that if you have commodity money, then the supply of through production of commodity money will also respond only to demand. If you increase the demand, if people increase their demands for money, then the production of commodity money will respond because of profit and loss, because it's more profitable to produce it. And so we'll go through this dynamic, and we'll get the proper amount of money according to the basic principle of economizing production according to profit and loss. There's no difference here than there would be for any other good. That would be the Austrian claim. Now, the monetary disequilibrium theorists say in response to this, well, but if all you have is commodity money production, you'll get price deflation when you have an increase in the demand for money. Right? And that creates all these problems. It creates all these dislocations and difficulties in the economy through sticky prices and so on and so forth. So that's what we want to talk about in the dynamic part. We want to move on to just talking about the dynamics of how the Austrians first and then the monetary disequilibrium theorists perceive the market adjusting. So let's start with the Austrian view. And I'm assuming just for the sake of the argument that that the Austrian position on the money supply is commodity money with 100% reserve banking. So let's just start with that. And then we can discuss whether there'd be adjustments to that or what sort of nuances might exist. But given that we have a monetary system like that, then the production of money would be integrated into the economizing rule of profit and loss for the production of anything. So we know that the production of anything, apples or men's dress shoes or whatever, always responds to the profitability of production that's made possible by our demand. So if our demand for men's dress shoes go up, price will rise, increases the profitability of production. The entrepreneurs will try to gear up production by buying more inputs. They'll bid up the somewhat the prices of the inputs, moderating the profitability as they sell more of the good. They'll moderate the price increase that we're generating through our demands. And we'll eventually reach another equilibrium situation where the rate of return is the same. Right? We've got the economizing use of resources by taking them out of lesser valued things and putting them into this more highly valued thing. We've got a perfect adjustment according to the principles of profit and loss. So the same thing happens with money. If we have commodity money, we increase our demand for money, the market value of money goes up, creates a greater rate of return, more profit from producing it. the mining companies, the minting companies gear up production. As they gear up production, they bid more for the factors. Factor prices rise. As they supply more money into the market, it moderates the price increase. And they'll continue to do this until we get the economizing result. Right? Resources are drawn out of other uses and into money production. And this is integrated completely with the production processes throughout the economy. The same thing is true of money certification. If we have 100% reserve money substitutes or money certificates, then their production would also be regulated by profit and loss. Customers would be willing to pay fees for the more convenient form of the medium of exchange. Banks would then incur the costs of production, and they would, how many money certificates would they produce relative to money proper would be determined by the profitability. They pay the fees, and then the banks, have to bear the expenses of, overseeing the checking accounts or printing the banknotes, whatever the form is that we would demand. So in both cases, money and money substitutes, in the Austrian conception, their production is regulated by profits, completely integrated into the production of all other goods and services. The amount produced is optimal. It's according to the economizing principle of the production of anything. Okay, so that's the Austrian position. Now, what about monetary disequilibrium theorists? Well, they say that, as I suggested before, that free banks would adjust the issue of fiduciary media to respond to changes in demand for fiduciary media. We're assuming, again, that all money proper is held as bank reserve. So the only medium of exchange that people use is deposits of money substitutes. Okay, so the story goes like this. We have a free bank. It chooses a reserve ratio. It chooses the reserve ratio by balancing the liquidity risk. If they extend the ratio down too far, they'll have a bank run. But if they keep it up too high, they'll lose out on interest. And so they find that the golden mean, that happy place where they can continue on and earn the maximum amount of interest without jeopardizing their liquidity. And given this desired ratio, the free bank issues fiduciary media, creates credit. Of course, they wouldn't call this created credit, but you get it. Issue fiduciary media, extend credit to the point where they hit the ratio. Right? They push their reserve ratio down to that point. And then at that point, if the public doesn't wish to hold the amount of fiduciary media they've created, then it will return to the bank for redemption. And this will put pressure on their reserves, and they'll have to build up their reserve position and adjust to that wish on the part of the public to hold their money substitutes. So... So their idea, again, is notice that they've rejected this notion that the optimal production of money can be determined or should be determined by profit and loss. In fact, they've assumed the same starting point that Adam Smith assumed. Right? That money, if you can produce fiat money, or in this case, fiduciary media, nearly costlessly, then you have to have some other standard to determine exactly what you consider the optimal amount of money to be. And of course, what they consider the optimal amount of money, as we've suggested already, is that amount of money that keeps the nominal spending stream the same, right? That prevents price deflation, at least. But this is entirely, whether or not price deflation is problematic, we'll get to. That's our last point, right? So we'll get to that at the very end. But from the viewpoint of general economic theorizing about optimal production, this is out of bounds, right? This is totally different. It's like just ad hocism. Okay, so let's think about whether or not we could justify this kind of claim that the monetary disequilibrium theorists make. Remember again, the standard claim about production is that economizing production requires those who have their preferences satisfied by the use of the resources to compensate those who will not have their preferences satisfied. They have to pay, in other words, people have to pay the opportunity cost of the resources they use in production to justify the economizing principle. You have to balance the value of what's produced against the value of what's not produced. And in order for this to be demonstrated in the market, you have to have exchange, voluntary exchange, between those who benefit and those who bear the opportunity cost. They have to be compensated, right? And it's the judgment in the minds of the resource owners who are compensated that the value of what's being produced by whoever is getting the resources from them is worth more than the value that they would put the resources to, because the compensation more than is adequate for them. They think that the worker thinks that the pay that he gets more than compensates him for the value of what he would use his labor for. Otherwise, or the owner of a steel mill, if he sells to General Motors his steel, he thinks the price more than compensates him for the alternative of selling to somebody else. That's why he does it, because there's a value spread between these options. Okay, so now before we go to fiduciary media, let's just think about fiat money with respect to this process. It's clear that the issue of fiat money then cannot be economizing. Because with the issue of fiat money, the person who issues it, the central bank or the government, or if it's a private party, they print the fiat money and then they just go into the market and spend it, and they displace the use of resources by other people without compensating them, right? They're just displaced. They buy the steel, they buy the cars, and so on and so forth, and other people are just don't get these things. And so we could never say that that's economizing, because the producers of the fiat money have not paid the opportunity cost of the resources that they command to the people who own them. They haven't paid this compensation. They're just printing the money out of thin air and buying things. Notice then the other important point about this is we might ask the question, like the monetary disequilibrium theorists would ask, well, but won't demand limit the extent to which the fiat money can be produced? Wouldn't that be the case? And you can see that clearly the answer to this is no. And of course, the reason for going through this case is because I'm going to claim it's exactly the same as fiduciary media. So it looks like this, analytically. So the money market, the PPM, we start off here with the total stock. And we say, well, won't this total demand limit the extent, forget about profitability of production, won't it limit the extent to which the fiat money can be produced? And the answer, of course, is no, because as you produce more fiat money, the purchasing power of money will fall, and the quantity demanded will increase to absorb it, right? So demand is no limitation at all. You could produce the fiat money ad infinitum. Well, until it goes, its value goes to zero. And we would just slide down the demand curve. That demand curve provides no limitation to the production of fiat money at all. And so, whoever's producing the fiat money, the central bank, the state, a person, has to find some arbitrary, rule, a policy to limit production, because it isn't limited by demand. If you increase the demand, you'll push the price down and the quantity demand will increase. Okay, so I would claim the same thing happens with fiduciary issue. The analogy is complete, right? With fiduciary issue, the banks create credit out of thin air. They lend it to somebody. That person then is able to take the money and buy things. The opportunity cost is never paid to anyone. Notice the opportunity cost is not paid to the holder of the demand deposit. He bears no cost whatsoever. He gets exactly what he wants, which is this form of the money substitute. He gets the present good, the satisfaction of holding the money in his hand right now. He's not paying any opportunity cost at all. He gets what he wants. And so does the borrower of the created credit. From whom are the resources transferred then? And the answer is just people in general, right? As the borrower goes out and spends, if he goes out and buys a new car, he displaces somebody who would have bought the car otherwise. If he goes out and buys, if he's an entrepreneur and he buys steel, he displaces another producer. but he never actually compensates the person who he never compensates a particular person in contract for the transfer of resources. Notice this is completely different from intermediated credit. The monetary disequilibrium theorists claim that this is the same, but it's completely different, right? When people intermediate credit, then the saver gives up command over the resources and transfers it to the borrower in contract. But the holder of a demand deposit doesn't do that. He's holding present money. He's not transferring anything, right? He's still physically, contractually holding on to his property. So the same thing would happen with the issue of fiduciary media. Demand cannot limit the issue of fiduciary.
It's going to do exactly the same thing. In other words, as more fiduciary media is issued, it's not going to come back to the banks for redemption. It's going to lower the purchasing power of money, and then people will want to hold more of it. And so its production can increase ad infinitum. There isn't anything that restricts it.
Okay, so that's my basic argument about the dynamics of this. Let me also point out a related issue. It seems to me that this argument that they make requires that the public's tolerance for the reserve is stable. That is to say, it isn't it's not the effect of the bank's policy. It's independently chosen by people, separate from the way that the bank is issuing fiduciary media. But what if the issue of fiduciary media can change the reserve ratio? Why wouldn't it do this? It at least seems to me an open question, because if the purchasing power of money goes down when they issue fiduciary media, people will want to hold more of it. This just means that they're willing to tolerate a lower reserve. I'm saying this under the existing situation, right? As Professor Salerno has already pointed out, if we eliminate all of the legal privileges that surround banking, then probably we would find that banks would have to hold near 100% reserve on deposits like this, just because otherwise they wouldn't have any clientele for the money substitute. It wouldn't be a money substitute. But that's a different issue. Okay. Now let me close. The last thing I want to talk about is the... before I go to this, I want to talk about deflation as the last thing. What's the Osterman response to the claim of the monetary disequilibrium theorist that price deflation is problematic? So we'll deal with that last. But before that, let me just mention one other thing, and we don't need to elaborate on this, but it was the claim I made before that any issue of fiduciary media sets in motion the malinvestments of the boom-bust cycle. And I think the reason for this, again, is that it changes the ratio of saving to consumption, right? Any issue of fiduciary media disrupts that time preference ratio of saving to consumption. And therefore, tends to stimulate the lengthening out of the structure of production and the eventual necessity for liquidation. Okay, so now let me turn to the last point, and this is about the claim of the monetary disequilibrium theorist that, well, if we had the Austrian monetary system intact, a commodity money system, then we get an increase in money demand, we get an increase in the production of money, but it would be insufficient to keep the nominal spending stream the same, and so we'd have price deflation, and somehow this is more disruptive, this creates, this kind of monetary disequilibrium creates havoc in the economy for various types of reasons. Remember, Jaeger and Horowitz claim that there's a prisoner's dilemma kind of problem, right? So you're an entrepreneur among all the other entrepreneurs, and you see that demand for your good is falling because demand for money has gone up. Your prices are falling. But you don't want to be the first one to cut your input prices because you think if you do this, you're going to lose all your workers, right? If you say you have to take a 10% wage cut or whatever. And so nobody wants to go first in this process of adjustment. And so it drags out. It doesn't drag out endlessly, but it drags out for a while. The other claim, we've mentioned a few of the other claims they make. Selgin, by the way, makes a somewhat different claim. He says, entrepreneurs can't tell the difference between a decline in the demand for their own product and a general decline of demand for all things, right? instances. And in the case of a general decline in the demand for all things, they should immediately adjust in one way. And if demand for their own products falling, they should adjust in a different way. But they can't tell the difference between the two. And so it sort of creates this fog where we go through this period of inefficiency because they're not adjusting properly. Okay, so anyway, what do the Austrians say about this? Well, I think the first point, hearkening back to something we said earlier, is that, and something that Professor Salerno has mentioned prominently, is that this whole question of price stickiness is a matter of choice. The degree to which prices are sticky or not sticky is a choice variable. So entrepreneurs build into their contractual relationships with other people the degree of price stickiness that other people desire, that all the parties mutually find reasonable. So the classic case of this, of course, would be annual salaried contracts or hourly wages that are set for 3 months or whatever. So there's instead of paying piecemeal every hour of the day or changing your wage every week or something of the sort, but just because it's better for the workers. They like this more, right? They're perfectly willing to accept some degree of alternative adjustment if the price of their labor is somewhat sticky. And this can be done retail too. So I think Joe posted up recently this case of some retailer, was it JCPenney's or Sears or somebody, that had this new policy that created more stickiness in their prices or less stickiness. I don't remember the details. So this is just, right, it's a matter of policy. And obviously then if conditions change, the entrepreneurs can renegotiate. People can see this and renegotiate, change the degree of stickiness of prices, and adjust. Okay, but so let's waive that consideration. Let's say there are prices are sticky in a problematic way, sticky downward. So we could increase money demand. Prices need to adjust downward, but for some reason they're sticky, and they don't immediately adjust downward. I think the next point to make is that entrepreneurs cannot, in fact, continue demanding inputs at the old level when their revenues fall. They can't continue to do this forever. Objective conditions of the world have changed. And regardless of what their expectations are or anything else, if their revenues go down, they can't just perpetually keep buying the inputs, right? They'll exhaust their capital and go out of business. They have to adjust. There's no prisoner's dilemma here. They just eventually they have to see that an adjustment is necessary in what they pay for inputs, precisely because their actual net income is evaporating. And it doesn't matter whether, this comes from the money side or the good side, right? The exact same effect occurs. Their net income, I should say, is being reduced. And they can't just sit there and say, well, I'm not worried about it. I'm not going to adjust to this. Right? They have to think about the best way to adjust to this. Now, let's suppose, though, that they have this Selgin confusion about whether or not this is a general or a specific change, and they're not really sure, should I adjust my input prices down, pay less for them in the face of this, sort of immediate downturn of my revenues. And I think the answer here is, of course, that this is precisely what entrepreneurs hold equity to do. Is to accommodate the degree of uncertainty they have about changes in what's happening to the profitability of their company, that they're not willing to immediately adapt to by changing their demands for inputs, changing the prices they pay. So if we had an entrepreneur and his revenues go down and he doesn't change the prices that he pays for his inputs, then the capital value of the resources he owns will decline, right? Who wants to invest now in this business? His stock price will fall. Who's going to invest in this business when the rate of return is falling? But the very fact that his capital, the capital that he owns, the very fact that the prices of that capital are falling means that his cost structure is going down. In the interim, he loses his equity. That's why all entrepreneurs hold equity, right? They hold equity, as Guido Holtzman likes to say, they hold equity as a buffer. It's a buffer against their, lack of perfect foresight. So naturally, what entrepreneurs do is they hold a lot of equity, they hold sufficient equity, And then when these adjustments, these downward adjustments in prices occur, they can accommodate these changes without making entrepreneurial mistakes, without, you know, jumping in too quickly and cutting their production when they should have left it the same. Because this isn't a specific decline in their own product, but a general decline in demands throughout the economy. So I don't think that this is particular. I think that the market can easily accommodate this kind of downward pressure on prices in general through just the normal entrepreneurial holding of equity. It means capital losses, but again, the very capital losses lower cost structures and restore the profitability of production. Okay, so at this point, let's open up for any ideas you have, comments.
Mm-hmm. So you said
must be really important.
So you said that there's always, when anyone increases or decreases their demand for money, buying or selling goods, there's always a synchronous change,
right,
in demand for money versus goods.
Right.
Now, doesn't that simply define away the whole problem of monetary disequilibrium immediately?
Which problem are you referring to?
Monetary disequilibrium.
No, I mean...
One problem.
You mean the existence of monetary disequilibrium?
Yeah.
It does in one sense, but not in another. So that's why I divided the talk into the idea of market clearing. What exactly do we mean by the existence of monetary disequilibrium? I think it does eliminate that. I don't think there is monetary disequilibrium in that sense, any more than there's a plain state of rest disequilibrium in any goods market. But then there is the question of the dynamic adjustment, right, which is different. So that's still an open question. Sure, there could be disequilibrium here, right? There could be. We don't immediately move to the final state of rest, the new configuration of prices. That so we are in disequilibrium with respect to the forces of change that are set in motion by an increase in demand for money or whatever it is. But remember, as Laura Davison pointed out, the way the market adjusts to this is by moving through a sequence of plain states of rest that eventually then wind up in this new configuration of prices. So that there's not monetary disequilibrium moment by moment, right? There's just the necessity of moving from one array of prices to another array of prices.
Cool. And what I'm saying is that is the only conception of monetary disequilibrium.
Yes, that's what I would say. Yes. Right.
Walter? When you talk about changes in the stock of goods from changes in technology, what about changes in technology that aren't created by the entrepreneurs, like just... Exogenous, like somebody discovers a technology randomly or
randomly?
Well,
really?
They attempt to earn monetary profit.
Well, but I would say it still requires an integration into the overall activity of human action, right? It still requires the person to have devoted his labor here and not in the market. If he's tinkering in his garage or whatever. Then it still affects the market result. He's still integrated all of what he's doing with respect, unless he's just a hermit who lives in the hills, and then he invents nuclear fusion or whatever, brings it like Prometheus, gives it to us as a gift. I'm not really sure. You see what I'm saying? I mean, I think it's still sort of integrated into the configuration that the market has adjusted to with respect to what everyone is doing in allocating their resources toward tinkering and making an innovation or not.
So you're saying it could come from leisure?
Right,
garage for fun and then blah.
Or from some activity that had nothing to do with the demand for the consumer good.
But it's still... Okay, maybe I'm just not seeing your point. It's still... If a person takes leisure, though, he's still integrating his leisure into what he does in the market.
Okay. Yeah.
So, right? So I don't see that that's an exceptional case. I'm not saying you couldn't have an exceptional case. I just don't... That seems like just another example of an instance of how someone might be allocating with respect to markets relative to other activity that they engage in. Joe?
I have a question. How would you respond to somebody who believes in monetary disequilibrium theory by, in your first, okay, so you say that the change in goods, the demand for goods, and I'll say demand for goods falls, we're talking about goods markets. Huh. They would say, okay, I'll agree with you there, or they may say this, but that it doesn't mean that the velocity of money doesn't change, and that therefore the flow of, of nominal income doesn't change. Because then there's a change that's a monetary equilibrium. I guess you were just trying to show that how that's just the reverse side of the coin and analysis to the change in demand for money, right?
Right.
It just is initiated in, okay.
Yeah, I think
but
so.
But they would still respond to it. They would say that is a monetary disequilibrium.
That's correct. I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah.
And what they have is this asymmetry between the good side and the money side.
Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned at one point scarcity of money as being sort of either or scarcity or surplus really is indicative of the problem of monetary disequilibrium. And that wouldn't be a problem. And then you base that on the idea of the plain states of rest always being in equilibrium. But if the real problem of monetary disequilibrium is in terms of final states of rest, then can't that still be a problem?
No, I don't think so, because the economy goes through a sequence of market clearing steps, and in each of those sequence of plain states of rest, there is no monetary
disequilibrium between final state of rest as conceived of as what will be attained as the result of a particular change, not that it's the equilibrium in the plain state of rest at every point along the way. That's not a problem. The problem is, how far away did this change get you from this final state of rest? And that's the disequilibrium notion. And so if there can be a scarcity of money in the sense that a change in the money or the good side has caused this need to change the final state of rest, and it takes a series of plain states of rest over time to get there. Right. That's the disequilibrium problem.
That is the problem that we're trying to analyze.
But I'm not sure it's a disequilibrium. In other words, we say we have these markets. Let's just say it's in the iPad. And we have this, whatever it is, this price today is clearing. And let's suppose, just for the sake of argument, that we're going to transition to, the configuration of demands is going to change. And we're going to transition. It hasn't changed yet because the market clearing prices, whatever it is today. But it's going to be a reconfiguration, and this is going to go sometime in the future. This is going to be, client demand conditions will be different, and this will be 350 or whatever. So, but I wouldn't call the difference between this and this a disequilibrium.
Well, that's what they're calling disequilibrium.
No. They're saying there's in existing conditions in the market right now, there's a difference between. They're saying that this is. They're saying that if to change my example, they're saying that if demand goes up like this, it immediately creates a disequilibrium. And we're saying no, it doesn't. We're saying it does not do that at all. If this guy comes into the store, if five more guys come into the store and buy, and if the price stays the same. You have an Apple store, and they've got 10 iPads in the back, and five customers they didn't expect come in and buy the iPads, and they charge them $500. That market cleared. If they then say the next day, I think this is a trend, maybe we got to boost the price to $600, then the market clears on that day.
There's the new classical one.
No, because the new classical school says that. The new classical school follows the disequilibrium school in saying there's an immediate, whatever the changing conditions of demands are, demand today, this is demand that emerges, out here 5 weeks from today, whatever, then we get an instant adjustment in price. That's not what we're saying at all. We're not saying that we get an instant adjustment in the price today and the price that will be
but between individual actors you are.
Right, but that's how the world really is. That's what entrepreneurs hold inventories precisely to adjust to those unforeseen circumstances without changing the price, because that's what customers want. If customers wanted the price to change moment by moment, then the entrepreneurs would in fact do that. They just don't. How is that not market clearing if the entrepreneurs want to do it this way? If they say, you know, my customers don't want me to jack up the price in the face of the increased demand day by day, but, you know, over time, I'm going
to
do it.
Everyone is pretty much by definition doing what they want to do, and the problem they've described it can still exist in that framework. You're just talking about something different than what they're talking about.
Maybe that's true. I'm not saying that that's like a... I'm not saying that this particular point is, you know, crushes the monetary disequilibrium theory. I'm not claiming that at all. I'm just saying, let's clarify what we're speaking about. Let's just be clear about what one view says versus another. And what they're saying about market clearing is not what we're saying. And when they say it the way they do, they're involved in certain kinds of errors by implication later on, because they say things like, if inventories build up, the market is not cleared. Well, no, that's just wrong.
Well, if it's aiming at a certain final state,
but we don't.
Even if you don't know, the problem isn't necessarily that you don't know what's going on. There can be a problem even if it can't be conceived of simply by people on the spot.
But it's the entrepreneurs who decide this. It's not us, right? It's the market participants themselves who decide what clears markets and what doesn't.
Is decided by what market demands are, which are decided by...
They're decided within the configuration of all the different aspects of the profitability of providing the consumer satisfactions. And some of this has to do with whether or not prices are sticky, or whether or not people want adjustment, they want prices to be stable day to day, or however you want to put this. It doesn't indicate that there's non-market clearing. I think their view of it is too objective. I think whether or not market's clear depends upon the trading partners in the market. It depends on their subjective view, not our uncertainty about them, but about them, what they're doing.
And I'm saying the conception they're working with, they're calling disequilibrium something different. Luminger says all over his papers about how he went and talked to one of his professors back when he was in school, and the question he had asked him presupposed that there could be a difference in the amount of money that someone wanted to hold and the amount of money that they were holding. The professor didn't understand. This professor said everyone's cash balance is essentially they acquired voluntarily in selling some sort of good, so they obviously demand to hold every unit of currency that they're holding. That there's no problem of a difference between those two. And I think this is in line with what you were saying.
Oh no, not at all. No. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that each individual person is always satisfied with their situation. I'm saying that when people come together and make exchanges, then they come into a plain state of rest. In other words, we can deduce from
that that's not what he's talking about.
But you just changed to talking about Jaeger saying that somebody can never be dissatisfied with the amount of money they're holding. No, of course that's just.
But in this framework, working with a sequence of plain states of rest, you'll always be in a plain state of rest, and in that sense,
you will come into plain states of rest when you go into the market and exchange with people based upon the change that you have in your own preferences to hold one thing versus another. So you're constantly changing your minds about, oh, I have too much money, I don't have enough money. That's why I did the preference rank switching around, right? People change their minds and now they're dissatisfied. When they go into the market, they do so to become satisfied. They find other trading partners who come into this relationship to be mutually satisfied. They're perfectly willing to do the same thing on the other side of the market. If they're not, then of course we don't have a market. We wouldn't have trade, and the people would be right. They have to go somewhere else
to
find
the problem they're talking about out of that. It's not about plain states of rest. It's about the sort of final state of rest that needs to occur.
That's why we talked about the dynamics.
It's all about
I guess the reason why is because we wanted to draw out of, they too have to define what they mean by disequilibrium, and we wanted to draw out all the differences. That's what I'm saying, right? Here's what how the Austrians would view the notion of disequilibrium, how we would see the dynamic. This is how they say it exists, and then there might be points of contrast between those two ways of conceiving of things that lead us to certain insights about who's right and who's wrong, or at least better insights into what exactly they're saying or what we're saying.
What I got out of your lecture was that so long as plain states of rest are emerging, there's no problem that we can describe in the market.
Oh, no, not at all.
Okay, so then how do you respond to the problem of monetary disequilibrium? Is it a problem?
At the end I talked about how Austrians would conceive of the claim that monetary disequilibrium theorists make, that price deflation is problematic. Okay, that's my answer, part of my answer. That's, right? Aren't I addressing their argument by going through, you know, the counter position about what would happen in an actual scenario of price deflation? Because this would happen in a world configured the way the Austrians.
But they would, of course, say that eventually, in the long run, something along those lines, that you do get the sort of adjustment process that all of the Austrians do describe. What they say is that it's problematic that such a process has to occur, and that there are other ways which would be better in comparison.
Yeah, well, you know, whether you found my answer satisfactory or not, I guess is a matter of your own judgment. I mean, these are positions are open to debate, I suppose, but I don't see exactly what long run has to do with what I said. What I said was entrepreneurs, when they face these sorts of problems of adjustment, they intentionally hold equity so that when the adjustment, when they aren't clear, as they don't immediately change things, they're not clear as to what is going to happen, they create for themselves a buffer by which, as things play out, they can then perceive better. And, of course, they lose their capital in this if they're wrong, and they gain their capital if they're better.
One of the main inspirations for the monetary disequilibrium school, I think, originated in large part of that idea. It's one of his main points, that it's all about this sort of buffer range in terms of equity or inventory that allows people, by the chain, entrepreneurs working in this capacity to adjust to these sort of uncertain price and quantity adjustments they need to make in terms of...
But it's not inventories. It's their equity. It's their capital value. It's the price of the assets they hold. That's what's adjusting.
The inventory is an asset.
No, but he's talking about physical adjustment. He's talking about building up the physical amount of the good or that you hold. I don't think it's quite the same. But in any case, that's one part of it. Then the other part is on the dynamics is, well, what happens in their world? Because they claim, of course, that when the banks issue fiduciary media, it doesn't generate any. It solves problems instead of generating.
Free banking and monetary disequilibrium concepts can be fully separated. You don't need any sort of fiduciary. You can have the problem. Monetary disequilibrium doesn't presuppose inside money or any sort of banking system. You could have the problem if everyone was just exchanging gold coins on the market. The problem is that there's a general discrepancy between the amounts of money that people are holding and the amount they wish to hold at some point in the future. It's a dynamic problem that requires a change in prices in general across the economy.
Well, that would be news to a lot of those guys, that you could have any monetary regime and it would be a suitable monetary regime with respect to disequilibrium in the money.
The concept of free banking as a monetary regime solves the problem of monetary disequilibrium. It doesn't presuppose that the problem of monetary disequilibrium only exists in that frame.
We're talking about the solution, though, right? We're talking about their proposed solution. So,
said the problem of monetary, at the very beginning of your lecture, I think you said the problem of monetary disequilibrium rests on certain conditions. One of the conditions that you stated was that people are all only using inside money as reference.
No. I said that's what they say. I was just saying you have to start with some actual expression of the monetary disequilibrium view. So I took Horowitz and Selgin and so on. So that's what I just said. This is what they say. I wasn't.
They ever say it's a condition. If monetary disequilibrium isn't a problem outside of this framework, why would the framework be a solution?
No. What
only exists within their solution.
All I said was that their argument is that a fully mature banking system, a free banking system, money proper would be held by banks as a reserve. That's all I said. That in their ideal situation, all of the actual medium of exchange is deposits. That's all I said. I didn't.
That's an assumption.
Well, but that's their assumption. I'm just saying this is how,
I don't think it's a necessary assumption, but that's an issue of free banking, not monetary disequilibrium. The problems won't.
Yeah, okay, sure, the problems are different, but the point is that they're the ones. I have to take somebody as a sort of archetype to, who's saying, who's advancing monetary disequilibrium theory, who's an advocate of it, and what they say about the ideal monetary system given their view of monetary disequilibrium. Sure, you could take a different figure, I suppose, and we would have a different, somewhat different configuration. No, it's not. I didn't say that at all. I said their view is that a fully mature free banking system that would have as a used medium of exchange only fiduciary medium. That's their view. No, I didn't say that's a condition. I just said let's take them at their word and work with that. If they have a different conception. If they allow for different conceptions, well, I talked about that too. What if in, like we have in the real world, people want to hold both cash and demand deposits? What then happens? How does this change the situation?
May I suggest we make concluding remarks and then adjourn?
Sure. We're over time.
I'm sorry. All right. That's it then. Great. Thank you.